You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Indigent Defense Center. And today we're speaking with immigration attorney Barbara Taylor. Barbara, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you became an immigration attorney or to practice immigration law?
Sure. I've been an immigration lawyer since 2006. I spent 16 years at Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, including as the head of their rural Maine project. And for eight years, I worked for the Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services, which is now the Maine Commission on Public Defense Services. And I went to law school very late in life, and the only area I've practiced in is immigration law.
What attracted you to that area of law? Did you know that that was what you were interested in when you went to law school, or is it something you discovered in law school or in that process?
Discovered in law school, actually, by volunteering at ILAP and really enjoying just the multi-generational contact with the clients. But the whole reason I went to law school to begin with is probably because I was the youngest child of several children. I spent a lot of my childhood saying, that's not fair. And my parents spent a lot of time saying, yeah, life isn't fair, which is true. But life doesn't promise to be fair, but our legal system does. And when I saw both the unfairness and then the just huge disadvantage of people, particularly low-income people, trying to navigate the immigration legal system, I liked the idea of helping people navigate it and understand it. It's very complicated.
I still ask you to explain it to me every time I have an immigration issue. So I agree with you on that. You've mentioned ILAP in terms of your working with them. And then again, as part of your law school experience, that's the Immigration Law Advocacy Project. I think I have that right.
Immigration Legal Advocacy
Legal.
Project. Yeah.
Sorry. Great. Thank you. What role does that serve in Maine?
It's been around for decades. It was founded by Beth Stickney and Peter Darvin, who's now a judge. And it has been really the only low-income immigrant legal service nonprofit in Maine for a long, long time. And its focus is on the most vulnerable immigrants. It doesn't do business or employment immigration law, but it's grown enormously in the interim, and it's a huge asset to the state. But like all other legal services, is having a really, really hard time keeping up with the need for legal services in Maine.
I think that you're absolutely right. And it's not just criminal representation and child protective cases or Pine Tree Legal for various civil assistance to indigent folks, that there's sort of across the spectrum with public service agencies or firms or people trying to meet those needs, that there's a higher demand than there is the ability to meet them. I think that's important to realize that it's much more widespread than some of our own little silo that we're in. But speaking of the silo that we're primarily in this, or almost exclusively in this office, juvenile and mostly adult criminal representation, what is different about the consequences and what can flow from an arrest or a charge or a conviction for someone who's not a citizen versus a citizen? I know that's a very long answer.
I'll try to keep it really brief. there's a huge difference because a non-citizen in Maine, besides being subject to all Maine civil and criminal laws, is subject to federal immigration law. And federal immigration law is not only huge and complicated, but some of it is very, very punitive and harsh. And as a result, some very minor state criminal matters and even some civil matters can have attached to them huge federal immigration penalties. And because of that, it's required for all criminal defense attorneys, before they allow anything to go forward with a non-citizen defendant, to first find out how this is going to affect their immigration current situation and future, and to try to avoid extreme penalties. And when I say penalties, I mean things like deportation, which can attach to very minor criminal matters.
And when you say that defense attorneys are required to know the consequences, the impact of the charge or the conviction for their non-citizen clients. That's really is all criminal defense attorneys, as opposed to just indigent defense attorneys, which either are working for a public defender's office, a small amount and growing in Maine, or working as contract attorneys through the commission, which has training and best practices. But because of the Padilla Supreme Court case, it applies to the fanciest defense attorney. They're have to know the answers to those questions as well.
Yes, that decision was a federal Supreme Court decision. It applies to all criminal defense lawyers anywhere in the country. They are all required to both give every non-citizen defense, well, first of all, to determine if their client might in fact not be a US citizen, which is not always obvious, to give that n a non-citizen client accurate and exact information about the immigration penalties that may attach to their current charges, and they must seek to mitigate those penalties or avoid them altogether if possible. Of course, expecting criminal defense lawyers to learn an entire area of federal law as complicated and changeable and detailed as immigration law is unreasonable. And criminal defense attorneys have for decades been collaborating with and working closely with immigration lawyers in figuring out that both that information and those strategies for their clients.
And even before our current Commission on Indigent Legal Services or Public Defense Services existed, I collaborated with you and other defense attorneys as well when you were working at ILAP. And it's very fortunate that the commission recognized the importance, especially after Padilla, of being able to give accurate advice to our non-citizen clients and entered into the contract so that we could ask you questions, because you're right, I do not know and follow and stay up to date on immigration law and the impacts on my clients. And dozens and dozens of times I've talked about cases and clients and their situations. And so thank you, first of all, for that. But I guess we're fortunate here in Maine that our indigent defense services have access to that resource the same way that someone with money, with a hired attorney, they would be able to also consult with an immigration attorney on their own. So that's a very good part of our system in Maine. The language around this sometimes I think may be inaccurate, or the way we describe the impacts, because if it's my life to my clients, these aren't these consequences, these impacts aren't collateral. They're front and center, usually way more of an impact and a result of the charges or a conviction than whatever the charge or the conviction might be. But they get lumped in discussions and some trainings with collateral consequences. What
Not if I have anything to do with
right.
it.
And so what, first of all, what's a better way to describe them when we're talking to our clients and probably even advocating to the court in negotiating with the DAs? Collateral consequences, I think, sort of in my mind, minimizes the impact, but there's probably a host of unintended, no pun intended, impacts that it has on the clients and the way they feel, and whether they feel further marginalized. But from immigration lawyers' point of view, and with your experience working much more closely with non-citizens, what are some of the reasons that I haven't thought of and we haven't talked about or mentioned in terms of from using that unfortunate term, and what's a better way to describe them?
Well, a better way is to use the term that the United States Supreme Court did in 2010 when it handed down the Padilla decision. It basically said expressly, immigration consequences are no longer collateral and cannot be treated as collateral. And if you do treat them as collateral, that's ineffective assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment. So they were very clear about the front and center importance of figuring out immigration penalties and seeking to avoid them. There was no equivocating at all. I know that it was a change. And I mean, that happened in 2010. And I know that I get inquiries where people still refer to them as collateral consequences. But defense attorneys should understand that being judged as an effective lawyer very much turns on their not only taking those into consideration, but beginning with those, you start out by figuring out if your client is a non-citizen. From the very beginning, you want to know if they're a non-citizen, what their particular immigration situation is, what their status is, what their history is. All those things are going to be absolutely essential going forward, either in negotiating with the prosecutor or making decisions about whether to go to trial, whether to accept a plea, and so on. So I think once defense lawyers understand how pivotal these things are, they begin to take them into consideration much earlier in their representation of their clients.
And I think that that is the good way to think of it, because even when I'm processing cases with a non-citizen, most of the cases I have with non-citizen, I probably should be putting in my mind, at least, you know, the immigration consequences first, because for most of them, it's more important than the class of crime. If we're dealing with misdemeanors and things like that, I think it could help a defense attorney's mindset, or at least mine, by thinking about it as a, this isn't an OAS or an OUI. This is a potential deportation because of the misdemeanor OUI I have. I think in the mind, it just sort of changes it a bit. So not just by the language we use, but our mindset. And I think that you should continue to have something to say about it, so we stop talking about it as collateral consequences, even amongst ourselves. I think psychologically, when we're talking to the judges and the prosecutors, if we make the point that that you did and that the Supreme Court did in Padilla, that it's not collateral, it's front and center, hopefully that will shift some of their responses or indifference in worst case scenarios as to the impacts that this is having. Just before the break, when a non-citizen has been arrested or summoned for a crime, what is the, even before court, is there some interaction that they may have with the immigration system even before they get to court and talk to a lawyer? We've talked about in a previous episode what individuals should do when they're interacting with law enforcement in general, not specifically for non-citizens, but is there, besides the law enforcement that they interact with in the particular case, might there be other officials that they have contact with even before they have an attorney or they've had a adjudication or on the case?
It's possible. The immigration law enforcement is called ICE, and ICE gets information about every arrest. There's a data sharing thing that's automatic. It's not optional. And ICE will know the minute somebody has been arrested and fingerprinted. And I think if it was someone that they were looking for or concerned about or whatever, they will have that information in advance. They are likely, if a person is arrested, to let the criminal stuff go forward. But at the same time, what they'll do is they'll reserve the right to put that person in immigration detention. They do this by something called a detainer. The person's in a state or county jail. A detainer is put on them. And even if they make bail or finish their sentence and are about to be released, they won't be released. They'll go from there to immigration detention. So far, we don't have ICE hanging around our local courthouses. That's just too hit or miss, and they get much better information by simply keeping track of arrest data and things of that sort.
I'm going to have some follow-up questions about the detainer issue after we come back from the break. You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner, and we're speaking with immigration attorney Barbara Taylor. Before the break, Barbara, you talked about or mentioned that there might be an immigration hold or immigration detention that applies to a particular client who's a non-citizen. If, for a defense attorney, if we have a client that where we know that they're in state custody, they haven't made bail yet, and we know that there is an immigration hold or an ICE hold, what are the consequences logistically and for the immigration case if we get their bail reduced, as we typically would try to do with a pending criminal charge? You know, what then happens? And usually we try to get the bail reduced before the case is done because it's easier to exercise your rights, because they take time to get your negotiation day and your hearing day and your trial day, and being stuck in jail is difficult for that. But if there's an ice hold, what happens like logistically? And then how does that affect negatively or if at all the immigration cases?
If someone is in jail and there is also an ICE detainer, the danger in making bail or finishing their sentence is when they go into ICE detention, that's a very different set of circumstances. ICE is allowed to detain a person anywhere in the United States they choose. And of course, that makes it very difficult both to work with their criminal defense attorney and to get their state charges resolved. It also makes it very difficult if they are facing an immigration penalty like deportation to work with an immigration lawyer and try to see if they might qualify for some form of relief from deportation. In other words, they can be whisked away and put in detention in a place that makes it very hard, not only for their family, but for anyone who's trying to help them legally.
So there may be situations where in order that they don't get whisked away and get into ICE custody, that an individual, a non-citizen, may be in custody on a state case that other, you know, that they might be able to make bail on so that they can have easy access to their defense attorney, have local to the court in, you know, at Cumberland County Jail, for example, for Portland, instead of, you know, Stratford County or someplace else in New Hampshire. And, you know, presumably the jail that they were taken to when they were arrested is more likely to be near where they were residing and therefore their family and other support. So for all those reasons, they m may be fighting the, or, you know, and trying to get the best outcome from the criminal charge from the jail cell, but that may actually be the smart way to go. Is that right?
That's true sometimes. It's particularly true if the detainer, the basis for ICE slapping on a detainer, is in fact the criminal charge. Because if that can be resolved, then ICE may no longer have a ground for holding them. So sometimes that is true. Again, because immigration law is complicated and so detailed, each person is going to be in a different situation depending on their particular immigration status, their particular history, and the charges against them.
If there were, you know, most of our listeners are undoubtedly non-lawyers. And so if there's someone listening who is a non-citizen or whose family members or friend is a non-citizen, what in terms of have you experienced that non-citizens, maybe especially those who aren't here on a, in a, on a legal status, sometimes are reluctant even to tell their own defense attorney and make it clear to them they're not a new citizen, not a citizen?
That information about their immigration status or that they have no current immigration status, and by the way, no current immigration status applies to 10 to 11 million people in the United States. They do absolutely want to tell their criminal defense lawyer that. That's key. The criminal defense lawyer, on the other hand, has no obligation, and it's often a very bad idea, to say that in court. All a criminal defense lawyer needs to say is, my client is a non-citizen, and therefore immigration consequences are going to be important to this case. They don't need to disclose their client's status, and often it's a very bad idea to do that.
Moving on a little bit, or moving away from the direct legal arenas in immigration court and in criminal courts, in terms of what I would characterize, and I'm sure you would, an unfortunate narrative and how non-citizens are described and discussed in society today and in the news. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, ways to talk about our non-citizen neighbors and clients and family members that counters the sort of stereotype by those that want to, you know, use them as a tool or to demonize them for their own purposes?
Well, there's several ways in which immigrants are demonized. If you mean specifically when it comes to things like crime, you know, if we're talking about the tired old myth of migrant crime surges or migrant crimes or migrants bringing crime to the United States, at this point, you know, it's very hard for people to believe information they get in the news. But for someone who's very skeptical and very certain that immigrants bring crime, especially undocumented immigrants, my suggestion would be that they go to a source they trust, like the FBI or the Department of Justice. And remember, the Department of Justice runs the immigration courts, runs deportation proceedings, appoints immigration judges and prosecutors. The Department of Justice has found that the undocumented immigrant offending rate in the U.S. is about half of the offending rate of U.S.-born citizens. And they did it not by studying Minnesota, but by studying Texas. They took every single arrest in Texas and used that over years to collect their data. I think they collected 6 years of data. And Texas, as a fiercely immigrant-aware state, made a point of recording the immigration status of every single person charged with a crime. Yeah, and the statistics speak for themselves. If you don't like that, the FBI has also done a study. I think their study was 5 years long at the state level. Oh, and by the way, the Department of Justice found there was no correlation at state, county, or neighborhood levels, both for violent and nonviolent crimes. FBI found that there was no correlation between the immigrant share of the population and the total crime rate in any state in the United States. If you think the news media is too liberal, go to those guys.
So there's in this the last election cycle and still there's some pretty extreme, to put it mildly, proposals that are being floated out there about at the federal level. That one that I've heard are changing the law that would require that any non-citizen who is even charged with a crime, any crime, that they be detained and deported. Putting aside the, I mean, the moral impact of that, I think is pretty big. But what would that actually do to like the millions
really
of people that are here?
It's really important to be realistic about this, okay? Yeah. First of all, non-citizens can be detained by the president and all the executive agencies. Detention doesn't mean deportation. There's a second process. Once you're detained, you go through deportation proceedings. So those are two different processes, both of which, by the way, are incredibly clogged and backlogged right now. So this wave of mass deportations that we've been promised are going to hit dead on a very, very clogged both detention system and deportation system. You may be referring to the Lake and Riley Act that's working its way through Congress right now, and it is being pushed back on by prosecutors big time. Here's what a group of prosecutors said. If we are detaining people automatically simply for being arrested, not even charged or convicted, fewer victims of crime will come forward. It will make it much more difficult for law enforcement to solve serious cases. Critical witnesses that are needed to prosecute people for serious violent crimes will be unavailable. And the only beneficiary of these bills are individuals who have committed serious crimes and who will escape accountability. So, yeah, the Lake and Riley Act is still a work in progress in the Senate. I believe Senator King is against it, but anybody who wants to contact his office and make sure is welcome to do this. But what I really wanted to say is we can get our hair on fire about the incoming administration, but the truth is an immigrant who shoplifts twice faces mandatory detention. And that's been true through the Biden administrations and the Obama administrations and everything else. This bill says like, okay, if they shoplift once, they go into mandatory detention and into deportation proceedings. Our system has been really draconian for a long time when it comes to minor crimes and major immigration penalties. The difference, I think, with the incoming administration is going to be the ability to create threats and rumor and fear and take advantage of fear. It can cause people to not to be afraid, who have no reason to think they're facing deportation, to be afraid to send their kids to school. Okay? The fear generated is going to be a huge factor. I think even a larger factor than the hugely clogged detention and deportation machinery. It's going to cause people to be afraid to use police, to be afraid to use our courts, our family courts, our criminal courts, any kinds of courts. And that's my biggest concern.
Before we close, I want to talk a little bit about what resources are out there for non-citizens facing criminal charges. In 2023, Maine passed a law that changed the different criteria where someone who's indigent could qualify to have counsel. Previously, in misdemeanor cases, if there wasn't a risk of jail, they weren't entitled to counsel under the most narrow view of the Sixth Amendment and the Maine Constitution. But it had broadened that and by adding two categories, one of which is if there were immigration consequences that could happen, even if there wasn't a requested jail sentence and you were indigent, you could get an assigned attorney or a public defender, depending on what part of the state you're in. But for folks who maybe they're not indigent, and so they don't qualify for a court-appointed attorney or a public defender because of that, obviously they can hire a defense attorney. But what's out there for non-citizens to reach out for the immigration advice if they're charged with a crime, if they're not, if they don't have an assigned attorney? And is there an issue with fraud? Are they vulnerable to hiring someone that, is there a problem with them hiring attorneys that aren't specialized enough, that don't have the experience to give the immigration advice that they're hoping to get from their attorney?
Sure, but that's nothing new. There's always been a problem. And part of it, because of language issues, people are much more likely to rely on people who speak their language and people who maybe even come from their own community. And a certain amount of misinformation or bad advice happens under those circumstances. I think Maine has an excellent immigration lawyer bar, most of whom would be very qualified to give somebody in a single consultation information on the immigration penalties they may face with their current criminal charges. And it's really good advice to get, a simple misdemeanor if you're in certain kinds of immigration status can cause you to lose your status and become deportable. Always, always get the information you need from an immigration lawyer, a reliable immigration lawyer, or legal representative before you agree to anything that's being offered to you in criminal court.
I think that's excellent advice, Barbara, and I thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time when we interview a group of Colby students to hear about the projects that they've worked on during their internship at the Maine Indigent Defense Center. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series. Take care.